I am Neo. Welcome into the Skeptic Arena. Today is September 6, 2009. The website is theskepticarena.com. Today's topic, homeopathy is not a cure, says the World Health Organization. People with conditions such as HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria should not rely on homeopathic treatments, according to the World Health Organization. It was responding to calls from young researchers who fear the promotion of homeopathy in the developing world could put people's lives at risk. The group Voice of Young Science Network has written to health ministers to set out the World Health Organization view. However, practitioners said there were areas where homeopathy could help. In a letter to the World Health Organization in June, the medics from the United Kingdom and Africa said, "We are calling on the World Health Organization to condemn the promotion of homeopathy for treating tuberculosis, infant diarrhea, influenza, malaria, and HIV. Homeopathy does not protect people from or treat these diseases. Those of us working with the most rural and impoverished people of the world already struggle to deliver the medical help that is needed. When homeopathy stands in place of effective treatment, lives are lost." Dr. Robert Hagen is a researcher in biomolecular science at the University of St. Andrews and a member of Voice of Young Science Network, which is part of the charity Sense About Science campaigning for evidence-based care. He said, "We need governments around the world to recognize the dangers of promoting homeopathy for life-threatening illnesses. We hope that by raising awareness of the World Health Organization's position on homeopathy, we will be supporting those people who are taking a stand against these potentially disastrous practices." Dr. Mario Raviglione, director of the Stop Tuberculosis Department at the World Health Organization, said, "Our evidence-based tuberculosis treatment management guidelines, as well as the International Standards of Tuberculosis Care, do not recommend the use of homeopathy." The doctors had also complained that homeopathy was being promoted as a treatment for diarrhea in children. But a spokesman for the World Health Organization Department of Child and Adolescent Health and Development said, "We have found no evidence to date that homeopathy would bring any benefit. Homeopathy does not focus on the treatment and prevention of dehydration, in total contradiction with the scientific basis and our recommendations for the management of diarrhea." Dr. Nick Bishing, a specialist in infectious diseases at the Royal Liverpool University Hospital, said, "Infections such as malaria, HIV, and tuberculosis all have a high mortality rate, but can usually be controlled or cured by a variety of proven treatments, for which there is ample experience and scientific trial data. There is no objective evidence that homeopathy has any effect on these infections, and I think it is irresponsible for a healthcare worker to promote the use of homeopathy in place of proven treatment for any life-threatening illness." However, Paula Ross, chief executive of the Society of Homeopaths, said it was right to raise concerns about promotion of homeopathy as a cure for tuberculosis, malaria, or HIV and AIDS. But, she added, "This is just another poorly wrapped attempt to discredit homeopathy." I'll butt into this report just to make a quick comment. They don't need to wrap their attempts to discredit homeopathy. Homeopathy has zero evidence for anything. Getting back to the article, the irony is that in their efforts to promote evidence in medicine, they have failed to do their own homework. There is a strong and growing evidence base for homeopathy, and most notably, this also includes childhood diarrhea. And I will butt in again to say that she is lying. If she had strong and growing evidence, the whole world would know about it. Continuing, the United Kingdom's Faculty of Homeopathy added that there was also evidence homeopathy could help people with seasonal flu. I'll butt in again. So where is this evidence? They always say they have evidence, and the world is waiting with open arms. No one's seen it yet. Back to the article. Dr. Sarah Eames, president of the faculty, said people should not be deprived of effective conventional medicines for serious disease. And I'll butt in again. I totally agree with her. And that does not include homeopathy. But she added, millions die each year as those affected have no access to these drugs. Well, the access to your drugs will not save one person since it's complete horseshit. And finally, she says, it therefore seems reasonable to consider what beneficial role homeopathy could play. What is needed is further research and investment into homeopathy. Well, that's just what they want. They want investment into homeopathy. So far, we haven't got a penny of return in the form of evidence. And now we move to the science segment. Saturn's rings disappeared. In a celestial feat any magician would appreciate, Saturn will make its wide but thin ring system disappear from our view August 11th. So that means this article is about a month old. Saturn's rings, loaded with ice and mud, boulders, and tiny moons, is 170,000 miles wide, but the shimmering setup is only about 30 feet thick. The rings harbor 35 trillion trillion tons of ice, dust, and rock. The rings shine because they reflect sunlight, but every 15 years the rings turn edge on to the sun and reflect almost no sunlight. The light reflecting off this extremely narrow band is so small that for all intents and purposes, the rings simply vanish. The rings remain a bit of a mystery. Scientists are not sure when or how they formed, though likely a collision of other objects was involved. Saturn's equator is tilted relative to its orbit around the sun by 27 degrees, similar to the 23-degree tilt of the Earth. As Saturn circles the sun, first one hemisphere and then the other is tilted sunward. This causes seasons on Saturn, just as Earth's tilt causes seasons on our planet. While Earth goes around the sun every 365 days or so, Saturn's annual orbit takes 29.7 years. So every 15 years, the attitude shift puts the gas giant planet's equator and its ring plane directly in line with sunlight. Scientists call it an equinox, and this one marks the arrival of spring to the giant planet's northern hemisphere. On Earth, equinoxes occur in March and September. Whenever equinox occurs on Saturn, sunlight will hit Saturn's thin rings, the ring plane, edge on. Galileo was the first to notice the rings and their then mysterious transformation in the 17th century. Through one of the first telescopes, which he built himself, Galileo discovered Saturn's rings. He didn't know what they were, since all he could see were two lobes attached to the planet like ears. He entered the newfound setup in his notebook as a tiny drawing. By December 1612, Galileo had studied the phenomena for more than 2 years, and the lobes, he thought they might be moons, were getting thinner. Then they disappeared. He wrote in a letter, "I do not know what to say in a case so surprising, so unlooked for, and so novel." Dutch mathematician Christian Huygens, using a better telescope, figured out what the rings were in 1655. That was about 40 years later. Galileo had every right to be mystified by the rings. While we know how Saturn pulls off its ring plane crossing illusion, we are still fascinated and mystified by Saturn's rings, and equinox is a great time for us to learn more. The edge-on setup casts shadows across the rings in a unique way that can reveal moonlets and other structures otherwise not visible. Cassini is watching for topographic features, perhaps some tiny moons or warps in the rings, and it has already spotted some mystery features in the days leading up to the equinox. In one new image, an object seems to have punched through one of the rings, dragging material with it to leave a visible scar. The craft's near-infrared and ultraviolet instruments will be on the hunt for signs of seasonal change on the planet. "We are not sure what we will find," Spilker said. "Like any great magician, Saturn never fails to impress." And now the arena goes abroad. Today we travel to Tripoli, Libya, where they had a homecoming for the Lockerbie bomber. Megrahi was welcomed by well-wishers on his arrival in Tripoli. The Libyan man, jailed in Scotland for blowing up a U.S. airliner over Lockerbie in 1988, has returned to his home in Libya after being set free. The Scottish government released Abdel Basset Ali Al-Megrahi, who is 57 and has terminal cancer, on compassionate grounds. United States President Barack Obama said the move was a mistake, and some relatives of U.S. victims reacted angrily. Most of the 270 people who died in the bombing were Americans. In a radio interview, Mr. Obama said, "We have been in contact with the Scottish government, indicating that we objected to this and we thought it was a mistake." He added that his administration had told the Libyan government that Megrahi should not receive a hero's welcome and should be placed under house arrest. In London, a spokesman for the Foreign Office said any decision to release Megrahi was for the Scottish government and ministers to take, as they have done. Correspondents say the Libyan authorities will regard his release as a triumph. Hundreds of people wave Libyan and Scottish flags as his plane landed at Tripoli Airport. Within minutes, Megrahi was whisked away for a meeting with his elderly mother. It was a jet owned by leader Colonel Muammar Gaddafi that carried Megrahi back to Libya after his release on Thursday from Scotland's Greenock prison. On arrival, he appeared beside the Libyan leader's son, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, who described his release as a courageous step by the British and Scottish governments. Local media reports said Megrahi would probably meet Colonel Gaddafi on Friday. So the leader of their country is only a colonel? The Scottish government said it had consulted widely before Justice Secretary Kenny McCaskill made his decision on applications for Megrahi's compassionate release or his transfer to a Libyan jail. Mr. McCaskill told a news conference he had rejected the application for a prisoner transfer. However, after taking medical advice, it was expected that 3 months was a reasonable estimate of the time Megrahi had left to live. He said the fact that Megrahi's victims were shown no compassion was not a reason for us to deny compassion to him and his family in his final days. In a statement released after his departure from Greenock, Megrahi continued to protest his innocence, saying his final days were being lived under the shadow of the wrongness of my conviction. "I have been faced with an appalling choice, to risk dying in prison in the hope that my name is cleared posthumously, or to return home still carrying the weight of the guilty verdict, which will never now be lifted." Megrahi's return was welcomed in Libya. "This person is innocent. Thank God he's coming home. This is a cheerful day for the whole Libyan people," one man in Tripoli said. But the families of American victims of the Lockerbie bomber reacted angrily to the news. Megrahi was convicted of murder in January 2001 at a trial held under Scottish law in the Netherlands. The final segment of the show, Famous Quotes. Today, Dr. Kenneth Fetter is a professor of archaeology at Central Connecticut State University. He has authored several books on archaeology and criticism of pseudo-archaeology, such as Frauds, Myths, and Mysteries. He gained his Bachelor of Arts in Anthropology in 1973 from the State University of New York at Stony Brook, his Master of Arts in Anthropology from the University of Connecticut in 1975, and his PhD in Anthropology in 1982. He is founder and director of the Farmington River Archaeological Project, which studies the prehistory of the region. He has also appeared on the Ancient Astronauts episode of the National Geographic Channel's Is It Real? and several episodes of the BBC documentary series Horizon, discussing Atlantis and Corral. In 2004, he spoke at the World Skeptics Congress in Italy. And now for the quote from Kenneth Fetter. In every generation, thinkers, writers, scholars, charlatans, and kooks, these are not necessarily mutually exclusive categories, attempt to cast the past in an image either they or the public desire or find comforting. And now the arena goes to the callers. Guest number one, welcome into the Skeptic Arena.
Hello, Neil. Thank you for welcoming me. How did you know it was your UK friend?
Well, as much as I hate to say this, I don't have many callers who are willing to enter the Skeptic Arena because this is rather a brutal arena. It's not designed to make friends or tell people what they want to hear. It's designed as a combat arena where the weapons are ideas and people must be able to defend their ideas with logic and reason.
I find that people, even if they know how to use logic, which is an unusual gift, but even if they do, very often when their dearest possession, in other words, their beliefs, their unprovable beliefs are challenged, they will give up logic and go to the realm of pure self-defense through emotional rationalization. Don't you find that yourself?
I could not have stated it better.
Why, thank you, Neo. We're in total agreement. I'm fascinated by the way that the human mind will take logic and rationality so far and no further. That is a particular interest of mine. And the way I see it, for me, religions are simply undisprovable belief systems, and they exist purely in the minds and fantasies of their adherents. They don't have any universal truth. What would you think about that?
I agreed with most of what you said. When you use the word disprovable, if you were referring to their entire belief system, then I would agree. However, let's take Christianity, as that is the one that's the largest in the UK and America. There are many, many things that can be disproven in their holy book. Now, that doesn't mean you can disprove their entire belief system, but you can certainly rip apart many of their beliefs. However, the fact that they refuse to acknowledge that their argument's been defeated, they seem to feel that as long as they simply deny it, that they are still in the game, and that is not true. For instance, they often attempt to misuse the second law of thermodynamics to claim that it supports their beliefs when, in fact, it thoroughly refutes one of their most important beliefs, and that is eternal life. It's odd that they use that as one of their supporting scientific theories because it completely...
Are you referring to the law of entropy?
Yes. And they claim that their God violates that law. They also claim that they are going to live forever with him, thereby violating that law. So I wonder why people would even have the ill logic to try to claim support from a law which they violate. That you can't get any more illogical than that, and yet they do.
My experience of true believers is that they delight in being illogical, because this is a confirmation of their belief. Because remember, Christians rely on faith. Definition of faith is believing in something that you just hope is true. The more you believe in it and have faith, the more true it is. And of course, this is totally illogical and very sad, very, very sad.
I don't have a problem with that. If they're honest enough to say, I believe I'm going to live forever with God and that God has always existed forever because I have faith that the Bible is true. We have no argument. I have nothing more to say to them. They have every right to believe that. But my issue is with the American evangelical movement, known as the far right here, where they have tried to distort, as I just gave an example, the second law of thermodynamics, where they try to distort and claim support from science, and yet every...
Oh, for creationism and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's another term for them, is creationism.
Oh, sure, sure, yeah, I know. Sad when they descend, they pretend to go into the realm of science, whereas really it's a bit pathetic. They just do it. I've heard a lot of talks by these people. They do it for their own people, their own uneducated, not very bright people, just to try and keep them in the religious arena so they can keep harvesting their dollars.
Exactly right. And they strain for the credibility that only science can grant, and that's why they do it.
Yeah.
But science disproves everything they believe in. The first law of thermodynamics, they violate that one when they claim that God created everything out of nothing. And the first law states that matter can neither be created nor destroyed. The law of gravity, where Jesus walked on water. The law of physics, where Moses parted the Red Sea. The law of evolution, where God created man out of dirt. Every law in science is broken by these people, and that's why your first comment about they have a disprovable belief system, I just took a minor issue with that,
I take your point.
Yeah, they can be disproven.
I take your point because when you're talking about these creationist evangelicals, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's just if you're dealing with other kind of fundamentalists who don't try and justify it scientifically and just appeal to faith alone, you know.
We call them progressive Christians.
Oh, really?
Fundamentalists are the ones who take the Bible literally, word for word. However, get a load of this. Here's what these literalists do when the words don't work out the way they want them to. They claimed for 1,600 years that the Earth was the center of the universe and that the sun was circling the Earth. And then when Galileo proved them wrong, they wanted to kill him. But he had influential friends, so he was able to live out his life under house arrest. And now, of course, they have to admit that they were wrong. Although some of them still don't. Some of them still believe that the sun goes around the
Earth.
Actually,
the Roman Catholic Church has at last belatedly apologized to Galileo. Isn't that funny?
Yeah, that was Pope John Paul II who did that. However, what they're doing now, if you read their literature, is they're claiming that whenever they write about Genesis, they call it, instead of calling it a day, they call it revolutions of the Earth, because that's what it is. But that's not what the Bible says it is. They've had to reinterpret the Bible so that they don't look like complete imbeciles.
Right, gotcha.
That's what they've done.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I remember from last time, too, you got a particular thing about these fundamentalists and evangelicals and all that. And quite right, too. It's easy meet with them. I mean, they're so pathetic. It's too easy.
No, they comprise about 50% of the American population, which means they run our country, which is why George Bush was our president for 8 years. He was one of them.
They voted him in.
Yeah, so your comment, while I understand what you meant, they're pathetic, but they're not. You cannot take these people lightly.
I get it. All right, they're powerful.
They're powerful.
Ideas are pathetic. They are, in fact, very powerful because
in America,
in a democracy, the majority rules. And if the majority are totally dumb and poisonous, well, that's what you're going to get.
That's why I was pointing out that you can't look upon these people as pathetic imbeciles because they have a lot of power.
They are imbeciles, but they're not pathetic. You're right. You're right. They are very powerful.
And that's another thing. They're also, many of them are not imbeciles. They have a list of PhD scientists that they use to add credibility. And these scientists are so afraid that the threats in the Bible might be true that they are willing to make incredible defenses that get them slaughtered in the scientific community, but they are the ones who stand up for these evangelicals, because they are evangelicals, but they are quite well educated. That's why James Randi makes a very good distinction between people who are educated and people who are smart. They're not the same thing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, to me, academia, you know, the intellectuality of the universities, for the most part, is pretty dumb. Most creative people work outside the universities. There's hardly ever been an invention of any value in a university, for instance. You might not agree with me. Perhaps we've found a source of disagreement there. I don't know. Of course, I'm well aware from last time that you're very keen on scientific materialism or dialectical materialism, which is the academic norm.
Well, it's not the academic norm. It's the only norm that's been proven. The other norms have to be accepted on faith.
Yeah, I understand. And I remember, I just thought I'd get back to, remember we finally found a source of disagreement last time and had a bit of fun with it, which is that I said, I'm more skeptical than you. You see, this is it. Who's more skeptical? I think I'm more skeptical than you because I'm skeptical of the premises of scientific materialism, which is that, which might be summed up as that is real. The test of reality or truth is that which is observable and provable through the evidence of the five senses. And of course, to me, that is merely a hypothesis that may or may not be true. And I'm skeptical about that because I don't think you can prove that's true. And I think you either take it on faith and believe it, or you hold it as a hypothesis and you say, well, if it were true, then this would follow, which to me would be quite honest. And that would be being properly skeptical. But if you actually believe that truth lies purely in the evidence of the five senses, that's a belief that I am skeptical of. So there you are. And that's where I think we disagreed last time, in a very friendly way. Do you remember that?
Yeah, and it's true until you can prove differently.
What's true? That the five senses evidence is the only acceptable. You see, when you say that, when you say it's true unless you can prove otherwise, to me that's just a faith statement, and I'm skeptical of it. That's an axiom, you see.
No, it's the opposite of faith, because it's only accepting what can be proven. Faith is based on non-evidence, means you don't have any
proof.
But
you say that's only accepting what can be proven, but in brackets, you really imply what can be proven through the evidence of the five senses.
Well, if you can find another way to prove it, everybody's more than happy to look at it. All you have to do is produce it. But until you do, a rationalist will only accept what has been proven.
But you're implying that proof is only through the evidence of the five senses. I think you're doing a circular argument here.
No, you're taking it as an implication.
Well, I think we have to define proof a bit more here with respect, because, for instance, I think that there are various levels of proof. There's material proof, there's logical proof, and there's also proof through maybe experiences that can't be externalized into the physical world. Like, for instance, I might decide to investigate the possibility of some sort of psychic phenomenon, and I might be able to, for instance, read someone's mind. I don't know, it's just an example, but I, you know, or I might be able to kind of extrapolate my consciousness and observe or work out what's going on another planet or something. There are lots of people who claim they can do this sort of thing. It's completely unprovable. Be able to share this experience with others and form a cult and all have a belief system and all that sort of thing.
But it's not untestable.
And that's just an example of other kinds of proof.
No, but it's you said it's unprovable, but that doesn't mean it's untestable. You can test psychic ability. Well, we have done many tests of psychic ability. The Ganzfeld experiments.
I know James Randi is the great debunker, isn't he? And he's brilliant. He's very, very good. Because he was a magician. He knows how they do things.
Well, not just him, but, I mean, there's been all kinds of people all over the world who've experimented in what's called PSI, you know, psychic, kinetic.
PSI.
Yeah. And we're still waiting the proof. If any one of them can prove it, it will then be accepted as science. But as of yet...
Well, of course, the thing is, when you say proof, you mean prove in a conventional scientific sense, which means using the evidence of the five senses. And I would say that's simply, again, being quite self-referential, because to people who say they experience psychic phenomena, they would ask it, they would suggest that in order to experience this, you would have to open your mind beyond your belief system that only the five senses tell the truth. And that's, in fact, what a lot of them say. Yeah?
So you're saying this is a sixth sense? Is that what you're calling it?
Ah, it's just another way of saying it. Well, a sixth sense, just a crude way of talking about... I mean, for instance, take the electromagnetic spectrum. You know, the fact that our human senses can only, in an organic sense, take in tiny bits. Like, for instance, the light spectrum that we can see with our eyes is tiny. It's just a tiny fragment of the electromagnetic frequency spectrum. And the same with and sound is very crude. In other words, our five organic senses are just tiny peepholes into an infinite world of vibration.
But we have tools that have enabled us to increase them.
I know, and we can use tools, but these tools, they can't do everything.
For instance, our eyes, as you pointed out, only see one of the seven divisions of the electromagnetic spectrum. Using our tools, we can see all seven, from gamma rays to X-rays to ultraviolet to infrared to microwaves to radio waves. So
yeah,
we've
what about beyond that?
That's all that we have. I mean, I've never heard that there are any.
Well, I mean, that's just the same. I mean, that's all we have. I mean, that's all we can go. But surely, theoretically, there's an infinite range of frequencies.
Well, that's not true, because you're talking about an electromagnetic wave, and you're talking about the frequency of that wave. So it's not infinite. At some point, there will no longer be a wave, and that'll be the end of it. And at another point, you'll have it. For instance, the gamma rays are the highest frequency, and so
yeah.
Anything that's above that frequency is called a gamma ray, and that's where it ends. There's nothing, I mean, there's no way to go beyond the ends, because the ends define either no wave or the maximum frequency of the wave.
These definitions, to me, are merely faith statements. They say, you know, these are... let me just put it like this. Okay, I understand where you're coming from, and you have a very good knowledge of science, and I respect that. It's great, and I really don't have an argument with you about science and religion and all that. But let me put it like this. Okay, for instance, I'll tell you. Have you ever taken LSD or magic mushrooms or anything like that?
No.
No. No. Okay. Well, millions of people have. And a lot of them report phenomena that are way outside the realm of science.
What do you mean, outside?
And they have agreed, they have common experiences. A bit like another one is after-death experience, where people, what do you call it? Those when people...
Out of body.
When they're on drugs about, you know, on the point of death, on the surgery room, and so many people report, you know, that they'll be looking down at their body and all that, and maybe they'll... see a kind of a tube that they'll be going up, and in the end, if their body recovers, they'll be taken right back into the body again. And so many people report that this was a life-changing experience, that before that they'd been, as it were, materialists, and after that they used words like spiritual, believed in life after death and stuff like this. You see what I mean? I mean, I think even a determined skeptical scientific materialist could open his mind to the possibility that this is, to the individual concerned, a definite proof of a transcendent reality.
How is it transcendent? You're just using your brain to experience things.
Well, when they report being out of the body, looking down at the body, well, they're looking down at the body with the brain in it, so they're not obviously, in their experience, working within the brain, or as a function of the brain.
You're assuming that a spirit has floated up and is looking down at the body and brain. What science believes is that these images are only occurring in the brain that is on the body on the table. They don't accept that a spirit has floated up and is looking down. And until someone proves that, that's what science will continue to believe. But if someone does prove it, then science will change its position.
Well, Okay, I hear you, and you put it very well, and that is the respectable intellectual position that you're enunciating, and I respect that, but to me, it's just simply that it's unprovable. You know, it's unprovable in scientific terms, and until you experience it yourself, then, you know, just a personal thing. In other words, it's subjective, and I understand that science is all about objectivity, and I do observe in my meetings with people that people who take scientific objectivity to an extreme are very often lose their emotional warmth. They tend to become quite brittle and sometimes defensive and aggressive, to lose their love and tolerance. Science demands objectivity, whereas love is subjective and can't be proved.
All these things that you've talked about, you're assuming that they exist outside of the body and mind. And love and out-of-body experiences and psi and all this stuff, the more they are learning about the human brain, the more they study and map out which regions of the brain are responsible for religious reactions, for emotions, for love, the more they're finding that they can explain almost all the things you've mentioned in materialistic terms, as these things are the result of the neural activity in your brain.
Yes, I'm aware that they say this, and I know that they can go a long way towards this, but I would say that they are merely constructing a rationale, and that they're supposed proofs are not foolproof. I think they are merely exploring the infinite potential of the human brain, right? Because it is a huge universe of neurons.
That's not true for everyone.
Explain yourself, please. What are you saying?
When you said a huge universe of neurons, I was thinking of some people I know to whom that would not apply.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's true that the human brain, if you exercise the brain, like if you exercise a muscle, the brain can be an almost infinite source of amazing knowledge, wisdom, and all that sort of thing. It is true that it's a fantastic organism. Other cultures, for instance, the ancient Greeks didn't think of the brain as a thinking organism. The ancient Greeks thought that the heart was the organ of thought.
That's why they were ancient Greeks. They thought the sun was circling the earth, too. These are not the people that you want to get your ideas from. Although they did have some good ideas on government.
They knew the earth was a sphere, and they measured it pretty accurately, and they measured the distance of the sun from the earth pretty accurately. They weren't fools. And the fact that they thought the sun revolved around the earth, well, it does in one system. It does. The earth, it just depends on your point of perspective. Really, it is true that from one perspective, the sun does circle around the earth.
Well, you're changing the definition.
It's simpler and more and much better for astronomy to regard the earth as circling around the sun. But it's not truer. It's just simpler in a mathematical sense.
Now, you're changing the definition.
Yeah, explain.
In fact, to be precise, the planets are not even technically circling the sun. The exact center of our solar system happens to lie about 40,000 miles outside the sun. So if you wanted to catch your friends, you could you would actually be right, and they would be wrong if they said that in our solar system, all the planets are circling the sun. Because while that may be true, the sun is also circling what is called the center of gravity of the solar system.
Tell you the truth, I thought I knew everything. I thought I was omniscient, but I've never heard that one. And I'm quite prepared to believe it might be true.
No. Hold it. One thing about the skeptic arena, you never take what I say as true. That's the number one rule.
Instead, I'm quite prepared to believe it might be true.
Let me give you the reference.
That's fascinating. If that's true, then I'm really excited about that. That's brilliant.
Let me give you a little background before I give you the reference. There was a website where, you know, anybody can put up a website, and some guy said, because of the mass of the sun, He was completely sure that the center of the solar system had to be located somewhere in the center of the sun. So I sent him an email referring him to Isaac Asimov, one of the great scientists of our time, where his book actually does the computations. And my brother, who's quite an engineer himself, he also worked out the computations, which of course came out the same because they're going to come out the same. And the center of the solar system is actually about 40,000 miles above the surface of the sun, because as large as the sun is, Jupiter is just large enough to affect the balance.
It's the Jupiter effect.
Yes.
I totally understand what you're saying. I think that sounds very, 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 you know, good physics. I haven't thought about it before, but it does make sense.
I always thought everything circled the sun, too. Until I read Asimov's books, you know, for all intents and purposes, yeah, everything circles the sun. But if you really want to be technically correct, that's not really true because, you could say all the outer planets circle Earth. Well, yeah, they do, but they're not circling us. We're all circling the sun. Mm-hmm. And even the sun, this whole thing is a solar system. And at the center of gravity is what everything moves around. It doesn't move around the sun. It moves around the center of gravity.
Precisely. I think that's a fascinating... I've never thought about it before, and that's changed my perspective on it a bit. That's absolutely important, I think, to think of it like that, because that takes you to a higher level of visualization than just thinking of the sun as, you know, as a purely, you know, bright thing in the middle. So it's taking you more into the deeper implications of the of gravity, isn't it?
The most important thing is that you can actually see the mathematics. They're not that complicated. It's just basic engineering and math. You don't have to use calculus to do it. So you don't have to rely on people like this guy who put up the website and thought that, you know, the center was in the sun. You can compute it for yourself.
Well, just my common sense tells me it's true.
No,
I'm thinking about it.
No. Yeah. You said you were very skeptical. Don't start doing stuff like that now. Because common sense, the thing about common sense is it's different to everyone. To each person, common sense is what they believe. So if you go to an evangelical, they believe that they're using their common sense because to them, it's common sense. So a skeptic never uses that argument.
I understand. You can't use it if you're talking with religious people, but I was using it in the sense of basic logic that's accessible to any reasonable thinking person. That's all I meant by it.
It all depends on the mass of Jupiter, because if Jupiter were any, let's say like it was the size of Saturn, then the center of gravity of the solar system would be somewhere in the sun. It wouldn't be in the center of the sun.
Exactly.
But it would be in the sun. So that's why it's not common sense. You have to actually do the calculations and find out where the center of gravity is. Because not common sense, because you don't know how much effect the mass of Jupiter has until you do the computations. Once you do the computations, or like I didn't do them myself. I've got Isaac Asimov and my brother and other people. I don't need to do their math for them. I'm not saying you have to look at the sun every day when it rises in the east to make sure it's rising in the east. At some things you can accept, you know, as being facts because they've risen to the level of acceptability. For instance, evolution, which the religious people are constantly attacking because they have to, because it disproves the Genesis myth. But evolution has as much actual support as gravity. It is so established, there is no one, virtually, it's like 99% in the biological field that accept evolution. Now, when you get into the public, or even if you get into engineers and other people who don't study evolution, the percentages are going to drop because they don't know what they're talking about. They think because they're educated that they automatically know everything. The people who know about evolution are biologists. The people who know about star systems are astronomers. The people who know about plate tectonics are geologists. These are the people that know, you know, then can give us the best answers.
Well, okay, I understand, but I'd like to be a bit skeptical about what you were saying there. And I would say that all these specialists you're talking about, like take plate tectonics. Well, it is the conventional wisdom in academia that you get subduction. You know what I'm talking about, subduction.
Well, it's been proven.
It's actually quite controversial, and there's a lot of evidence against it. It's just the current belief of science. I mean, to go, it was very controversial. Now they believe it. I think in 50 years they'll probably believe something different. And that's the way I see all of science. For instance, there's a very reputable theory of an expanding Earth, which takes into account sees the shallow, which sees the young seas, and all seas are young, as evidence of an expanding Earth, and the fact that the Pacific Ocean is very new, it's only 200 million years old, and that you can contract all the countries around the Pacific Ocean and make them fit together like a jigsaw puzzle, just like you can make the countries around the Atlantic Ocean fit together. That can't be explained by subduction if it's the whole Earth, but it is explainable in terms of a gradually expanding Earth. And that bit saying that this is a perfectly acceptable scientific theory that is not that popular in the universities at the moment, because the universities are always just doing consensus faith, to my mind. And I will also mention the whole idea about conventional physics and astronomy at the moment believes that the gravity is the main force that drives the revolution of the and the circulation of planets and stars and all that.
No,
the evolution
of them. They don't believe that. They don't believe that because
they think it works through gravity very slowly, don't they?
You said no. Gravity is being overwhelmed by something more powerful. If that wasn't true, our universe would not be expanding it as it is.
Referring to the Big Bang and the expansion of the universe or something?
No. The Big Bang happened 13.7 billion years ago. I'm talking about right now. Our universe is expanding at an increasing rate of speed. If gravity was the most powerful, like you just made the statement that gravity was the most powerful, it cannot be.
Inform me. Help me out here. What is this more powerful force? Are you talking about the strong electromagnetic force or what?
No, if gravity was the most powerful force, everything would be being pulled together by the force of gravity.
So what is the force you're referring to?
Well, that's what scientists want to know. It's the expansion of the universe.
Well, good luck to them. All I'm saying is that the whole Big Bang, black holes, dark matter, expanding universe thing is, to my mind, just a fun theory, and other theories that relegate gravity to a very minor player and make electromagnetic force almost everything, and that see, for instance, the sun, rather than being a nuclear reactor, as being merely a focal point for electromagnetic forces, as it were, the cosmic plasma. Now, this is a completely different way of looking at things, and it's just not popular in the universities at the moment, and I think it'll probably become the conventional science in about 50 or 100 years. And so all I'm saying is that all these, what people believe, like Big Bang and all that sort of thing, whatever, it's just the popular myth of the day, which will be supplanted by an entirely different vision.
See, that's not
sometime
true.
In the future.
That what you said was false, because science only accepts the theories that are supported by the best evidence. And the theories that you're putting forth, whether it be the expanding Earth, the sun is a focal point for electromagnetic energy, all the theories you brought forth do not have the evidence. And that's why they don't have the support. And your hope that in 50 years you will win is called faith, and you're entitled to it. You can have faith that in 50 years everything is going to flip-flop and all your beliefs are going to be true. The beliefs that you have may be true, and in 50 years all your beliefs might be the rules. They might have the evidence to support them. Right now, all of the things you argued against about plate tectonics, the sun, the expanding earth, the Big Bang, all the beliefs or the theories that are ruling right now are the ones that have the most evidence, the ones that explain the observable evidence the best. That's what is accepted now. Gravity was ruling in the 1600s. Relativity ruled in the early 1900s. Quantum physics came along in 1930. Relativity and quantum physics did not replace gravity. Relativity added to the knowledge of gravity. Quantum physics added to the knowledge of relativity. And there may be something else coming along, like string theory, that will add to the knowledge of quantum physics. However, at this point in time, they're attempting to find the answers. And the position that you take is the position many take on string theory, that in 50 years it will be proven to be true. And maybe it will be. And at that time, it will become the king of the theories. But right now, it is only a theory, and it, like many theories, 9 out of 10 are dead ends. And string theory may just fall by the wayside. We don't know. But the rationalists accept the theories that are proven to be true at this point. And right now, whether it be the Big Bang, the expansion of the universe, plate tectonics, the nuclear fission within the sun, all these things are the best explanations for what our evidence shows us. I'd like to thank guest 2 and guest 3 for joining, but I'm over time and I have to end the show. You're welcome to call back in or log back in next week for the next show. And I apologize to guest 1. I don't know why I cannot unmute you, but if you call back next week, we can try it again. Anyway, thanks to everyone for joining, and that's going to be the end of the show.
Are you ready, Bruce? Start walking.